Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
It's Tuesday, 19th of November. I'm Andy Brassel, she's Jules Breach, and this is Jules and Andy on Football Ramble Daily. Coming up, with England safely qualified for Euro 2020, we'll be talking about what the tournament in all its various venues will be like, both for fans and for media working on it. Talking of media working on football, we'll be going inside Women's Football Weekend with Jules, who was at White Hart Lane, or the new Tottenham Hotspur Stadium, as some people still call it, not me, for the North London Derby between Tottenham and Arsenal. We'll also be looking into your correspondence via Twitter and the emails. That, of course, is julesandandy@footballrambledaily.com. More to come. Hey Jules, how's it going?
Hi Andy. Well, Women's Football Weekend was really exciting, so we'll talk more about that in a minute. But what else was happening this weekend was England qualifying for the Euros officially. I know they did it last week, but the last match against Kosovo on Sunday night, they're officially qualified.
And officially,
they did it
officially.
Clinical style. So go us. We're through. The Euros is on the way. The countdown begins now.
Yeah, and I don't think it's unreasonable to say one of the favourites because Spain in a mini rebuild. Germany are definitely in a rebuild. I think France are the only team that you look at and think, yeah, they're definitely a way ahead of where England are, or a way ahead of where anyone are. But it's a pretty open field. I mean, Belgium, can we completely trust them, even though they look fantastic in qualifying? We don't know. But now, especially with the playoff draw coming at the end of this Friday, and of course, there'll be various fans, maybe of Wales, depending on whether they qualify automatically. Northern Ireland, Republic of Ireland, Scotland, of course, looking forward to that. Then the week after, we've got the draw for the tournament. And I think before the draw for the tournament happens, it's very hard for people to visualise it, isn't it? Because normally, like, you can already start making tentative plans to go around Portugal with your mates in an unreliable hire car or wherever else. And when we get to 2024 in Germany, I think for a lot of people, that'll be a dream tournament. I mean, Germany's close. It's easy to get around by train or by car. No speed limit, of course, on the Autobahn. And, you know, they're all fantastic stadiums in incredible football cities. Now, there are a lot of incredible football cities involved in Euro 2020, but they're all in different countries.
It's just going to be a bit odd, I think. And the reason this is happening is to celebrate the 60th birthday of the competition, supposedly. But they're spreading it across 12 different countries, 12 different cities, 12 different countries. And logistically, as a fan, I know that there will be a lot of fans already now thinking, right, let's get our tickets, let's try and sort the tournament out and how we're going to plan the trip. And how can you when it's across so many different places and you don't really know where you're going to be for the next round? And it has a different feel to it, doesn't it? And the thing that worries me about how the tournament atmosphere is going to be is when you go to a big tournament and it's in one specific place, there's branding everywhere, there's football fans everywhere. The whole area is kind of captivated by this tournament. And that's the feeling and the atmosphere that you want. With it being spread across 12 different cities, yes, you might get that feeling in that place, but then what outside of it? And you know what it's like when you go to a tournament? You don't necessarily stay right there in and amongst it because A, it's really expensive. B, you might prefer to stay a little bit further out and then travel into near the stadium for the actual matches. But the whole feel of it's going to be a bit strange. And it was like the Women's World Cup in the summer when I went over there, because it was spread across so many different areas in France. Unless you were actually in one of the smaller little cities, you didn't really know that the Women's World Cup was on. And it was one of the things that I didn't like about it. And I'm a bit concerned that the Euros is going to feel the same.
Yeah, you know what? I also felt that about the Women's World Cup. And I stayed in Nice the whole time, which was one of the host cities. But on a match day, it felt like it was all on and it felt tournament-y. but it's kind of like they put a white cloth over everything, you know, like a hibernating house when it wasn't. So yeah, you're right. I think you didn't have that sense of perpetual tournament fever. So I do wonder how that will be. I mean, logistically, it does present its problems. There's no doubt about that. And I think, especially coming hot on the heels of the Russian World Cup, which obviously the logistics and I think people's fears about what it would be like, certainly cut down the numbers of people who were going there from England and from the UK. Obviously, Qatar in 2022, quite apart from the timing of it not being in the summer, that's going to have a few of the similar issues to Russia. And I think there are people probably as listening to this as we're speaking who are looking forward to Germany 2024 already. It does feel strange. I mean, obviously, there's also a cost-sharing element to it because as we speak about time and time again when we're talking about around not just major football tournaments but major sporting events, you know, there is always some dispute over how much legacy there really is in terms of jobs and infrastructure and all that for host nations, and are they spending money really that they shouldn't be? I mean, I personally think, like, the first Euros I went to as a fan outside England was the 2004 Euros. Yeah, 2004 Euros. I went across for a couple of games there. And obviously, I know Portugal pretty well and Portuguese football pretty well through work. And through a combination of speaking to people there at the time and speaking to people since, both football fans and non-football fans, even with really fervent football fans, there's a sense of, why have we spent all this money on that? You know, this was before the recession really hit. They're struggling with funding for education and hospitals and all this sort of stuff. And it's like, well, hang on. So we ended up building stadiums for clubs like Académica, Coimbra, Beira-Mar. And like some of those clubs had to move out because they couldn't afford the bills. Mm. You know, there were clubs who were getting like under 500 fans for top flight games in 30,000 stadiums, which is ridiculous. I mean, so from my perspective, and from I guess a lot of other people's perspectives, Portugal would have been way better off co-hosting that with Spain, because then Sporting, Benfica, Porto get their new stadiums. They continue to be well used and they continue to be worthwhile, and you don't create these number of white elephants. Now, that is the one thing that you've got to say about this tournament. Most of these facilities were already there.
They're ready-made, aren't they?
Yeah, and that they're stadiums that are going to continue paying for themselves. So I think from that perspective, and also I think if you look at a lot of these places, they're places with genuine football culture. And I think that when you go to a tournament, whether it be to part of a tournament or the whole thing, that matters. That really, really matters to get there and think that, you know, it's not just a curio for a month, but this is a place that really feels football, that has football in its bones, that has a football history. I think that really matters. Of course, you will get that in Germany in 2024 as well. But I think especially you've got to go back and think, they didn't have this idea to spread it across several countries like yesterday. This was something that happened like the best part of a decade ago. And you've got to think about the global and continental financial circumstances of the time as well. I think it's often overlooked what a heavy financial burden, at least the initial outlay, is for a country that's got to host a championship.
Yeah, that's true. And when we think about London and we think about Wembley, because of course that's where the semi-finals and the final are going to be held for the Euros, which is great. That's so exciting. That
backdoor home tournament, Jules.
On our doorstep. But also there's going to be some of the group games held at Wembley as well. England are going to be playing their for three group stage games, yeah, at Wembley. Slight advantage, isn't it?
A little.
But in terms of the tournament feel, I mean, we know what it's like. You know, I'm not originally from London. I'm from Brighton. So before I lived in London, if I was coming up to London to go to a game at Wembley and I wanted to stay the night in London, I wouldn't stay in Wembley. I would stay somewhere else in London, somewhere that's either, you know, a nicer area where there's something else that I want to go to near the theatre or whatever it might be the next day, or somewhere that a friend has said, why don't you go and stay there, for example. But
less camping in London than there is just outside Lisbon.
I don't think you'd camp for a game at Wembley. But for the tournament, this is the thing that worries me from a fan's perspective, is the game's going to be at Wembley. And if you've been to Wembley before, unless you're going to a game, you're not going to go to Wembley, the area, really.
No.
So I wonder what the rest of London is going to be like. Is there going to be a presence of that there's a big major tournament on, or is it going to be?
I think so.
Do you reckon there will be?
Yeah.
In Trafalgar Square or something?
Yeah, I genuinely do. And like, I think if you look back to, say, the 2013 Champions League final between Bayern and Dortmund at Wembley, and now, of course, this is partly conditioned by the fact that you have two German teams and two German rivals in the final, but you know, we've talked about this, I'm sure, before, but you could walk around London, and I talked about this in the a recent At the Match episode around the Berlin Derby as well, and we were saying, or Ross Dunbar from Union was saying to me as well, Berlin is kind of the same as London in that you could go about your daily business most days and football might not touch you. You know, it's not like going to Newcastle or Marseille or somewhere like that, or Liverpool, where, you know, you can't really avoid football. I think you can quite easily go about London, and even though there are 10 professional clubs, if you don't want anything to do with football, you can quite easily avoid it. That's not a problem. That wasn't really the case during the week leading up to that 2013 final. The German fans especially really brought something with them. The clubs got really involved, and it felt like the tournament was kind of taking over London, which as a novelty, I thought was a fantastic feeling. They had this festival at the Olympic Park, which was still being built up around then. Of course, it was just after the Olympics themselves, but they've developed the area around that for people who don't know London quite extensively since, but it was still quite, you know, an up and coming neighbourhood. It hadn't been even given its own postcode by that point. It ended up
Had Westfield though.
Yeah, that's true. It ended up having to borrow E20, which used to be like that fictitious shady nightclub in EastEnders. But I think it really did manage to do something for the city. So if one game can do that, I feel pretty firm that like a number of games during a tournament could definitely do that. And of course, the visitors that have come, as well as the English fans, will really add something to that.
Yeah, and that's really positive for the other cities involved as well, and the other countries that perhaps maybe you've never held a major match of that sort and that kind of level. So that will be good to see the kind of positive effect that the Euros has. Because I know at the moment, logistically, from a broadcasting perspective, speaking to other people that work in the media and how it's going to work, it's quite tricky, isn't it?
Because
one knows how you can logistically plan where you can be and the financial implications that has on the media as well, and being able to travel around. And how many crews do you book for 12 different cities? Do you book 12 different crews, or, you know, do you split one crew with three countries or with four countries? How does that work? And it's,
well, I guess
that's really interesting to see.
Baku's the interesting one, isn't it? Because it's just that little bit further out the way. You kind of look at them on the map and they're all dotted away, and then way off to the right hand side is Baku. So that's a different one to deal with. But I agree. I think from that perspective, the fans and the media are kind of in the same boat. Until the draw's made, no one really knows. Now, of course, we'll kind of be in suspense after the draw's been made. We'll be sitting there on the 1st of December, still waiting, knowing where most of the games are, knowing who most of the teams are, but there'll still be four we're waiting for, because, of course, the playoffs aren't until the end of March.
Yeah.
So we'll have to wait for that.
Be interesting. And you mentioned Baku there, which I worked on the Europa League final last season, and I'd be lying if I said I was buzzing that it was in Baku. I had no idea what to expect from this, from that country and that area. And I went there, and I have to say, I loved it. I thought it was brilliant. I thought it was great. And then the match kind of, it didn't live up to expectations, did it? The Europa League final particularly, although we did get the Eden Hazard retiring news off the back of that game, didn't we?
Yeah.
Sorry, not retiring, leaving Chelsea.
Wow.
He hasn't retired.
Talking's better than him, so he's packed it in now.
Yeah. So that was It was an interesting game, but as a place, I thought that Baku was actually really beautiful, and I wasn't.
The food's amazing.
It was amazing, and I was pleasantly surprised by it. So, where I would say that wherever your team in the Euros are playing, if you're a fan and you're planning to travel around and watch your country play in the Euros, or follow another country if that's your game, then I would say definitely go to even the places that you're not expecting to be nice, because they might pleasantly surprise you.
I'm off to Munich, I think. I fancy a bit of Munich.
You reckon?
A bit of Budapest. Can I fit Rome in? I don't know. Get Apple Maps out.
I'll do it.
The one that perhaps isn't nailed down more than any other is who plays alongside Maguire, assuming he's a certainty. Who is the other centre-back?
I think the way that Gareth Southgate's shaping up, it looks like it's going to be one holding midfield player and two number eights. If that's the case, then Harry Winks, the last couple of games, I think, has put himself into pole position ahead of Declan Rice.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
So your Sunday was pretty busy as well. I saw you there on the touchline at White Hart Lane, as I will continue to call it, even though that's
I never know what to
incorrect.
Call it. Whenever I'm like tweeting, or if I'm saying it.
When you say the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium,
I say Tottenham Hotspur
sounds weird.
Stadium because
it sounds weird,
that's the
it?
Official name, but it does sound a bit odd, really, doesn't it?
Yeah, when it's the Dunkin'
it's
Donuts, when it's
well.
The Dunkin' Donuts Arena or whatever it's eventually going to be called, that'll be proper, won't it? But when we were talking about it beforehand, the thing that really struck me, Jules, is that you said, in terms of the atmosphere, it felt like a men's match.
It did. It felt no different to me. When I arrived, we get there quite early when we're working on a game. So
yeah.
We're there maybe 4 hours before kickoff. So there's obviously not a lot going on at that point. But we're kind of locked away in a room, getting our hair and makeup sorted and prepping for the match. And then eventually, when we walked out pitch side, I was with Karen Carney, Natalie Quirk, who was hosting. I was doing the reporting, and then Danielle Carter, who's one of the Arsenal players. And we walked out and we all just went, wow. Wow. Like the atmosphere. I mean, this stadium is so impressive anyway. But walking out pitch side on Sunday in the North London Derby, to me, felt no different to when I've gone and walked out pitch side on a Champions League night when Tottenham played by Munich.
Well, that's
no different.
That's the thing that really struck me in the post matches, actually, Jules, when you were speaking to Leah Williamson, and was it Kim Little?
Yeah.
And Leah Williamson, she was another good 80s reference for you. She was glowing like the little Ready Breck guy. She was just totally like, you know, players always say, "I'm buzzing." She really was. You could see the energy coming off her as she was talking to you. The fact that they'd gone there as Arsenal fans, and that Tottenham had made a huge effort around the day. They'd sold a record amount of tickets, and it was an occasion. It was a real occasion. And the fact that Arsenal had gone there and managed to, you know, go into the Lions Den and pinch the points, of course they're the better team. Everyone knows that. But not easy at all. And like, they were totally vibing off that, weren't they?
Yeah, Leah Williamson's a lifelong Arsenal fan. So,
yeah.
I mean, she just loved every single minute of playing in that match. The North London Derby, the first ever one in the WSL. So that was a game that she was going to relish. And as you say, to come away with all 3 points from that match, she was absolutely buzzing. And it's really refreshing when you interview players like that who are so excited and so happy to be in that moment. Was a really nice thing to see. But as you say, it was another record-breaking attendance in the WSL. It's now the second time we've broken a record this season in the women's game domestically here in England. And that's just amazing to see. As you say, over 38,000. 38,000 fans. 38,000 fans to watch this match. It was quite incredible to see. And after the game, I spoke to the Tottenham manager, Juan Amoros. They actually manage as a duo. It's Karen Hills and Juan Amoros who manage, yes, Tottenham together. But Juan tends to do a lot of the media. And he's, I have to say, I know you shouldn't pick favourites, but he's probably one of my favourite football managers in the game. He's just the nicest man. And I interviewed him after the match, and obviously they'd just lost and he was disappointed, but he was really upbeat at the same time because he said the occasion was so special. And when I said to him, because he asked me, he said, what was the official attendance? So off, this was off camera. I said it was 38,282 or whatever it might was. And he said to me, wow. And he paused. And then when I actually did the interview on camera and I said to him, Juan, it was an incredible occasion today. Played in front of a new record attendance in the WSL of over 38,000 fans. How special is that for you to hear? And he said something which really sort of got me. And I thought, you're so right there. He said, 2 years ago, we had 38 fans coming to watch us.
Wow.
And he said, 2 years on, there are 38,000 people in this stadium. And I was like, that is an incredible amount of growth when you actually just stop for a minute and think about that and think, it's true. Tottenham weren't a professional club a couple of years ago. They've had the investment. They're now professional. They've got promoted to the WSL and they're playing their women's match in the North London Derby against Arsenal, who are the champions of the league and one of the most successful clubs in the women's game, in front of a crowd of 38,000 people at probably the best stadium in the country and one of the best stadiums in men's football. You just can't buy moments like that. It was amazing. And to see what it meant to him was really nice.
Yeah, and you got the impression that those teams and those players really made the most of the moment. It wasn't just Tottenham playing at the men's stadium. We've talked about it before in terms of, and not just profile, but in terms of respect, I think playing at the men's arena makes a massive difference. I mean, Leila Garrick of Brighton was one of the ones to make the most of that. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. Fantastic goal. So the quality on the pitch was absolutely fantastic as well. On an international weekend, and especially with England playing on the Friday and the Monday, was it a bit of a disappointment to you that they didn't spread the games across the 2 days?
You mean England men, as in England playing on Sunday and Friday?
Yeah, Thursday Sunday.
I was losing track of my days then. I was thinking, did they play last night? have I missed a game?
No, it's like a bank holiday. I've just lost track of the days.
That was, for me, that was probably the one thing I think that we maybe missed a trick on with this weekend. Women's Football Weekend, it was a great initiative and a great thing to think of doing on an international break when there isn't as much domestic men's football. So to make the most of having the fans available to attend the matches. But the trouble is that all the games were on the same day. They all played on Sunday. So there were all six matches, all played on Sunday. And I think that's a bit of a shame that they didn't split them and put a couple on the Saturday. Because then, for example, as we've already said, there were nearly 40,000 fans at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. But there was also Reading, who played their match at the Medeski, which is amazing that the girls got to play there. But the attendance was fairly low for that. And that's probably because the majority of fans who live in and around London, which includes Reading, because Reading's not that far outside of London, were probably going to attend the Tottenham game because it's an opportunity to go to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium.
Yeah.
So yeah, that was slightly disappointing because there were only, I think, about 1,500 people that went to the Medeski. Still a big number, don't get me wrong. It's not to be sniffed at, but I think they could have capitalised on that a bit more and perhaps played the Reading match on the Saturday. At the Amex Stadium, there were over 4,000 fans there, which I think is a really good turnout for Brighton. And at King's Meadow, over 4,000 fans, and that's not one of the men's stadiums. At Anfield, there were 23,000 fans, and that was a Merseyside derby. So brilliant to see that many fans out at Anfield as well. But yeah, I think that they maybe could have got a few more, because I think across the weekend there was around 75,000 fans attending women's matches, which is a huge number, but I feel like there could have been a few more.
Those fans, and hopefully some more fans, will be hopefully seeing bigger stars as time goes by, as bigger players get attracted to the WSL, potentially by some of those crowds as well. One who's definitely coming is Sam Kerr, and we've had some emails about her, Jules and Andy at footballrambledaily.com, of course. This one's from Stephen Grosso. Hi, Jules and Andy. Love the new show, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk about women's soccer. Chelsea's getting a good one in signing Sam Kerr. As a Chicago Red Stars season ticket holder, it was incredible seeing her consistently being the best player on the pitch, even when playing against the best that the US women's team has to offer. She's able to score from nothing, and her goal scoring rate speaks for itself. She's a nice person to boot to. We will miss her, so please enjoy her in England. There's another one kind of linked to that from Justin Visor. Thanks for getting in touch, Justin. It says, hi, Jules and Andy. With much being said lately around the difference in wages between male and female footballers, the Football Federation Australia, FFA, have struck a deal securing equal pay for Australian men's and women's national team players. Additionally, the Matilda's biggest star, Sam Kerr, has just signed a big money contract with Chelsea, reportedly around $600,000 a season, US dollars, that'd be something, which is getting towards championship level wages, I think. The story's made waves here in Australia, but I wonder what the reaction to this has been in the UK, Europe, if any. And is there any indication that other nations' federations might follow suit with a similar equal pay deal?
Huge news. Absolutely massive. And obviously, because I work for an Australian broadcaster, I hear about all of this very closely. And I mean, it's, first of all, the Sam Kerr deal has been a long time coming.
Yeah.
Sam has been desperate to play in Europe. From people that I know that know her quite well have told me over the years that she has been desperate to come to Europe and play.
Was England always her plan?
Well, not necessarily, because I think, you know, naturally in the women's game, whenever there's a star player, you assume they're going to go to Lyon because they're the best team in the world. So for Sam to choose Chelsea and to come to the WSL, I think it's just brilliant.
Well, it's a massive coup, especially when they're not in the Champions League at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. And that's obviously what Emma Hayes is hoping for, that the girls qualify for the Champions League for next year. And
so
January.
Okay.
Yeah, so she won't be playing this weekend coming, but I believe from January she's available to play.
Right.
And I'm so excited because she is one of the best strikers in the world. And I was talking to Karen Carney about this, who's obviously ex-Chelsea as well, and she was telling me over the weekend that what she really likes about this move is that in the Chelsea squad, the only other real number nine is Beth England.
Yeah.
And Beth's a brilliant player, but Sam arriving at the club will make Beth even better because she's going to be fighting for her place. And obviously there's now competition for that spot where there hasn't been before. And it's just going to make Chelsea a stronger team going forward. Of course it is. Sam Kerr's one of the best strikers in the world. And I think it's a great move, a really exciting one for the WSL and something that everyone is talking about. So yeah, amazing move for her. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's going to be fantastic, isn't it? And it was interesting, actually, seeing an interview with Lucy Bronze a while back, and she was saying that her medium to long-term aim at some point is to come back to England and win a Champions League.
Love that.
With an English team.
Yeah.
So I have to say it still seems a way off to me at the moment, simply because I think it's hard for anyone to wrest the title from Lyon. You know, it looks very, very difficult. Of course, on a weekend in which there was so much big action in the WSL, it was also the big one in France between Lyon and Paris Saint-Germain. Lyon won 1-0, of course. Sometimes, if anyone's going to challenge them domestically, it's going to be Paris Saint-Germain. But I think it shows how much, not just money, but planning, care and attention goes a really, really long way. Yeah. Because you would have thought at some point for them, it would be inevitable that Paris Saint-Germain would take over. But they've been trying to do that for 5-6 years now, a long time. They've tried all sorts of different routes. They've tried bringing in superstars from abroad. They've tried picking up former Lyon players to bring some of that winning magic into their team. And none of it has worked. I mean, it must be intensely frustrating for PSG, but it shows how far everyone else has got to catch up. And, you know, we talk about the investment that's been made in England, but also you look at what Bayern have done over the last couple of years. You look at what Barcelona have done over the last couple of years. Atletico, who've won the last two titles. I mean, Tony Duggan's ended up going there from Barcelona this season, hasn't she? Even though they've had quite a turnover of players. So it's kind of reflective, the Women's Champions League and the Men's Champions League at the moment, in that you can't just pin everything on winning it, because at the end of it, there can only be one. And just because you didn't get there, it doesn't mean the whole season has been a total write-off, because the competition is just so intense.
Yeah, it really is. And as you say, particularly in the Champions League, like Chelsea are such a strong team and they're not in it this year in the Women's Champions League.
It's amazing.
And that's just crazy when you think about it like that. So, yeah, I think Sam Kerr will only mean good things for Chelsea moving forward. And you never know, she could be what takes them to their next title.
Are we having an official correspondence section, Jules?
I think we are, officially.
We are.
So I put out an Instagram post just saying we're about to record. Any questions, send them in. So thank you to Nath Salt, who... I love that I have to read out screen names because you've not put your full name. I'm guessing you're a Nathan. Do you know him?
Yeah, I know him.
Actually?
Yeah, I genuinely know him.
Genuinely, do you?
Yeah, hi Nathan.
Hi Nathan. So Nathan said, Harry Wilson is an interesting one, excelling for Wales, but is the pathway there for him to go back to Liverpool and get a run? Or has he got to be sold, play regularly to then go back? Big decisions ahead for him.
You know what? If you'd have asked me that question even 6 months ago, I would have said transfer collateral. Going forward, there's no doubt about it. But you look at Liverpool, and what is the one thing they lack? A bit of creativity in the centre of the park. I mean, it's not completely off the table, is it? Mm. And he's excelled at every level. Every level up, he's gone. He's looked the part, and he's becoming a key player for Wales as well.
Yeah, and he's been absolutely brilliant for Bournemouth, hasn't he, this season? And it started off that he wasn't starting every game, and then he slowly worked his way more and more into the side. And now, for me, is an integral part to the Bournemouth squad.
Yeah, I think so. And I think as well, if you compare him to... It's quite a well-trodden path now, isn't it, from Liverpool to Bournemouth. And if you compare him with other players, young players with great potential, like Dominic Solanke, Jordan Ibe, they've not been able to impose themselves in anywhere near the way that Harry Wilson has been able to in such a short time. He's been absolutely central to what Bournemouth have done. And I said at the start of the season, for me, they're among the relegation favourites. Now, they've made me look a bit daft. They've been really, really good so far this season. I think their achievements are a little bit underrated so far. And he has been essential to that. I mean, he couldn't be doing any more. At the least, he's going to get a move to a bigger club next summer. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah, I agree. Thunder Austin, Jeff, hello, has sent this one in.
I know him.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I'm
joking. Not personally. I actually do. Well, only through Twitter Instagram.
Okay.
Someone who I speak to a lot on social media, who's always lovely and a big fantasy Premier League fan. Hey guys, loving the podcast. Such a refreshing perspective from you both. And he said, what's the best match you've ever seen live, and which match in history do you wish you'd seen live? Good question. I've been thinking about this because I read this about 10 minutes ago when Jeff sent it. So the best match I've ever seen live, there's two that really stick out. One was Brighton's match that sealed promotion to the Premier League, which was against Wigan at the Amex. I was about six rows from the front.
Right.
And as soon as the final whistle went, well, actually, probably about seven, eight minutes before it got to 90 minutes, you could just see all the stewards getting closer to the edge, closer to the pitch, to prevent everyone running on and doing a pitch invasion.
Did you get on the pitch anyway?
Of course I did. Absolutely. I wasn't missing that opportunity. So you could just see them just sort of like crowding round the edge and just being like, right, we're not going to let anyone get on this pitch. Not being funny. As soon as the final whistle went, there was just a stampede just onto the pitch. And I was like, I kind of looked at my mate and I was like, yeah, let's go. We just like went running on. And yeah, that was incredible. And you've, if you're not a Brighton fan, you've probably seen the pictures. If you weren't there and you weren't on the pitch, you've probably seen all the images of that. That was an amazing moment. And the other amazing live game I was at was the Liverpool comeback against Barcelona at Anfield.
Oh, that's a great choice.
Oh my God. I mean, I actually couldn't get over what I was seeing. It was just insane. That Trent Alexander-Arnold corner is something I will never forget. It was just, that match was mental. Absolutely mental.
It's funny. It is one of those matches that will just live in the memory for so long. But you're right. It already feels like a legendary moment in football history, despite the fact it was a relatively short time ago.
Yeah.
We were trick-or-treating in a road, not me personally, obviously.
Yeah, you were.
in a road parallel to us a couple of weeks ago. And I saw this lantern. There's one house at the top that always makes a massive effort for Halloween. And it had a big pumpkin sat on their fence outside. And, you know, someone, like, you know, you carve a scary face in it or like a little message in it. And this pumpkin had carved in it, corner taken quickly, Origi.
Amazing, really.
Because, yeah, it's one of those moments, isn't it?
It is one of those moments. And actually, when I first started working in football, I started collecting programmes from every live game that I went to. And I didn't think that I'd ever get as many as I did because I was just trying to make the most of it when I first started. So it started off with just loads of Brighton ones because that's where I started out.
Yeah.
And then eventually it got to a point where I was like, right, I've actually got nowhere to put any of these programmes. So I stopped doing it and I've stopped collecting them now because it just, to be honest, it got a bit pointless. I was like, I don't even know what I'm going to do with these programmes. Anyway, that match, I still have that programme and I'm never going to leave that because that is the best game I've ever worked at. It was just amazing.
That's a good one.
What about you?
Well, a neutral one. Yeah, I think I might have to go with Monaco 8, Deportivo La Coruña 3.
Oh,
that was pretty
goals.
Good. That was November 2003. And yeah, it was one of those, like you were saying about those sort of pinch yourself moments. My friend who I went with, we laughed all the way back to the station because we just couldn't get our heads around it. Yeah. It was fantastic. It was that brilliant Didier Deschamps Monaco side who got all the way to the final. And in fact, they would have ended up playing Deportivo in the final had Jose Mourinho's Porto not just edged them out in the second semi. So that was a really, really strange one. Absolutely fantastic. Never seen anything like it. And Monaco were an amazing team then. As far as Wimbledon goes, I would have to be one of two for the pitch invasion aspect.
You've not been on the pitch, have you, Andy? Have you done a pitch invasion?
Yeah, when Wimbledon stayed up on the last day of the season against Fleetwood, I can't remember the last time I felt that emotional over a football match, really. Just stayed up under Neil Ardley. And yeah, it's one of those things where you kind of almost couldn't avoid going on the pitch because King's Meadow is so small. If everyone else is going on, you're going on with them.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then you're on the pitch
Great
and you're
excuse.
Like, this is brilliant. And then you're on there and you're like, okay.
Now what?
What are we going to do now?
Yeah, that's exactly what it was like at the Amex.
Exactly. But that was a joyous occasion.
Well, look, keep sending
That's a great
your,
question.
It's a good question. Thanks for that, Jeff. Keep sending all your correspondence in to us at Jules Breach, at Andy Brassel. Jules and Andy at Football Ramble Daily is the email address as well.
Yeah, that's right. And we'll fit in one last email, almost inevitably. There's one that's coming from Cody Elson. Thanks for getting in touch. Cody, howdy Jules and Andy, love the show, was just emailing you to let you know of a recent decision I made. I know you're ready for this, Jules.
I'm so ready.
In all sports I watch, I pick a second team to support on the side.
Yes.
Not sure why, but I've always done it. Pack it in.
It's not going to be Wimbledon, is it?
Well, no, it's not. It wasn't until recently that I realised I didn't have a second football team and it was hard to choose one. In basketball it's easy, pick one Eastern Conference team and one Western Conference. Don't pick an Eastern Conference team. In AFL it's easy because I lived in multiple areas, so just pick the teams where I've lived. Football has really stumped me until I realised I should just pick the team with the most active Australian players since I'm Australian. So in conclusion, you've got another listener on board. The Brighton train and Jules can claim some more commission. God. Keep up the amazing work.
I should be paid commission. I'm getting so many new Brighton fans on board. Love that, Cody. Thank you very much. And thank you, Matt Ryan and Aaron Moy.
Yeah, thanks. Anyway, this has been a delight as always. Thanks for getting in touch. We do appreciate it when you get in touch on Twitter and by email. It really makes the show.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.